Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song, by Judith Tick. Narrated by Carmen Jewel Jones. Introduction. When my mother, Miriam Tick, was 88 years old, she told me about her silver slippers. As a teenager, she wore them when she and her cousin Irving went dancing at the Roseland Ballroom in Boston. She cried when she mentioned him, because he was killed in the war in 1944. Silver slippers announced to boys who might ask her to dance that they had to keep up. Sometimes she went to the Spanish Gables Dance Hall in Revere Beach, a town a few miles north from her home. I heard Chick Webb there, even before Ella. He was great. She said their names like they lived next door. She was born in 1918, and Ella was born in 1917, so they belonged to the same generation. My mother told me this story in 2007, knowing that I was planning to write a book about Ella Fitzgerald's musical odyssey. She died the following year, 5 years before I signed a book contract. I received this story as an unexpected and touching confirmation of her devotion to Ella Fitzgerald, which had filled our home with her music. 33 RPM LP albums were stacked upright, like books on the shelf, below the hi-fi record player that sat on the console in our living room, where popular music reigned supreme. And Ella Fitzgerald was always front and center. Indeed, when my father died in 2004, my brother delivered an alphabetical eulogy that included the words, "E is for Ella." In 1956, when I was 13, I memorized the double LP, Ella Fitzgerald Sings the Cole Porter Songbook. At the time, I had no way of knowing that this seminal album would be the first of 8 similarly assembled Fitzgerald songbook collections, each one curated with sophisticated cultural values, including the long verses to ballads and rediscovered esoteric gems. While I was just another listener, inhaling the lofty beauty of Fitzgerald's voice, I was also a teenager who adored the radical songs she sang with their aspirational lines of bravado. As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, "Fare thee well," Ella blithely sings in "Just One of Those Things." I quickly found a favorite line in Porter's comic, subversive, "Let's Do It" verse. People say in Boston, even beans do it. Then, in 1960, I brought my piano vocal selections book of Cole Porter songs to Smith College, a single-sex institution in western Massachusetts, where I was simultaneously introduced to the complexities of music and feminism. In a former working-class Victorian rooming house turned into a dormitory for 25 white girls, many times after dinner we gathered around the upright parlor piano and sang Porter's ballads and novelty songs. I heard Ella's thrilling, pure vinyl voice in my ears when we sang the line, "Every time we say goodbye, I die a little." I played the accompaniment at the piano and a tempo worthy of high tragedy. I did not know the phrase torch song. When we'd exhausted the Porter canon, we'd move on to George and Ira Gershwin, or Rodgers and Hart, or Irving Berlin. Our choices no doubt influenced by the other songbooks that Fitzgerald had recorded by that time. My fond girlhood memories of Ella Fitzgerald would inspire a more personal and decidedly ambitious pursuit in 2010, when I read an interview with Fitzgerald in which she explained how those songbooks I used to listen to, recorded 2 decades into what was already a thriving career, had marked a significant transformation in her artistry. In the 50s, I started singing with a different kind of style, picking out songwriters and singing their songs. Cole Porter was the first. It was like beginning all over again. People who never heard me suddenly heard songs which surprised them because they didn't think I could sing them. People always figure you could only do one thing. It was like another education. Those consequential songbooks represented a before and after demarcation in the long and colorful arc of Ella Fitzgerald's career. They suggested the ideas of becoming and transformation as potential themes for a book. For 20 years or so before they were recorded, roughly from 1935 to 1955, Fitzgerald had established herself as a quintessential jazz singer. She had started out as an impoverished young girl from Yonkers, who would later describe her boots as camouflage for her skinny legs. She achieved recognition through an amateur night contest at the Apollo Theater at age 17, and then in February 1935 got a real job through a week-long engagement at the Harlem Opera House. After being signed by Chick Webb, who initially said, "I don't want no girl singer," she began to transform the role of girl singer into a position of leadership. Her success at the microphone transformed not only her career, but also the status of other female vocalists throughout the music business. Before Fitzgerald, girl singers were typically relegated to a single chorus of a song. Following Ella's example, the Canaries, as the girls were called, flew higher, especially after Fitzgerald's swinging rendition of a classic children's nursery rhyme. "A Tisket, a Tasket" became a global hit in 1938. Yet management dressed her up in schoolgirl clothes, boxing her into an image that overstated her innocence and compromised the achievements of a budding artist and innovator. Nevertheless, Fitzgerald's drive to break new musical ground won the day as she programmed more adult fare into her act. After Webb died in 1939, she became the official conductor of the orchestra. In 1940, she said, "I used to sing nothing but jittery stuff, but now everybody likes me to sing sweet songs, so I give them a little of each." Fitzgerald's sweet and jittery musical transformations kept coming. In the mid-1940s, she swerved into improvisational bebop as her personal avenue for change, digging deeper into scat and inventing complex fantasias on single tunes almost at will. Her phonographic memory allowed her to become a one-woman jam session. That's what gave us females permission to dig in and do some improvising ourselves, said Betty Carter, a sister improviser. It was no longer a man's world. She treasured her stylistic breadth. "What is the Ella Fitzgerald style today?" Ebony Magazine asked in 1949. In the 1950s, touring as a member of the popular Jazz at the Philharmonic, JATP, ensemble, Ella joined a troupe of soloists, seizing the stage and announcing her arrival as a vocalist of astonishing agility. As keyboard legend Oscar Peterson recalled in his 2002 memoir, in the joint finales of a JATP concert, competing with the horns, she gave no concessions. She played rough. At one of these performances, tenor saxophonist Lester Young turned to Peterson and said, "You stay out there long enough, and Lady Fitz will lay waste to your ass." And yet, her soaring popularity notwithstanding, it was with those songbooks that Ella surpassed even herself, performing an artistic feat that would have been remarkable if attained by any artist, let alone a black woman. She transformed the culture of an entire repertoire, deftly infusing with swing the sophisticated show tunes from the golden age of Broadway musicals from the 1920s and 30s, shows that had left their mark on the Great White Way, an apt nickname for a cultural institution that had routinely excluded black artists from its stages. Through those 8 songbook albums, Fitzgerald dominated a category of standards, recording more than 250 of them. What lent the songbook's special authority was the way they enabled Fitzgerald to ignite a double transformation. By reinventing herself as a singer, she transformed a vintage repertoire, and by modernizing it, she laid the foundational stones for what would soon be known as the Great American Songbook. One transformation begat another. In the wake of her songbook's breakthrough, Ella enjoyed worldwide acclaim, not just as a popular singer whose appeal easily crossed geographical and cultural borders, but also as a classical artist who provided a creative, paradigmatic model for others, especially for the female singers populating the field, and even more especially for African-American artists. This brings me to the title of this book, Becoming Ella Fitzgerald. Over the course of my research, my purpose underwent its own transformation. When I initially conceived the title, Becoming Ella, I thought that the songbooks had vaulted Fitzgerald into that rare sorority of single-named artists. But that premise changed when I realized that, prior to the songbooks, she had already been Ella among Black Americans and the jazz world. Between 1933 and 1950, she performed mainly, but not exclusively, for Black audiences in ballrooms, and then in Black theaters, in colored show business, as it was widely known during the Jim Crow era, then moved into jazz clubs catering mostly, but not exclusively, to white audiences in the latter part of that era. The same model of diversity applied in her post-songbook decades. In the 1960s, she continued her artistic evolution as she perfected the hybrid idiom of jazz pop, experimenting with adaptations of soul while also deliberately engaging with a new generation of songwriters whose work she believed deserved the appellation standards. She insisted on reaching out to younger audiences, her lifeline to relevance. "I'm not going to be left behind," she said throughout the decades. "If you don't learn new songs, you're lost. I want to stay with it, and staying with it means communicating with the teenagers. I want them to understand me and like me." Across her entire career, the artist was always becoming Ella Fitzgerald. Though her trajectory made her a mixed singer, as she once described herself, she flourished in collaboration with the great jazz instrumentalists of her era. In this stretch of her career, in the late 1960s, Fitzgerald reached a peak of excellence touring with Duke Ellington, pushing many of his lesser-known songs into the jazz playbook. Her stature as the foremost interpreter of Ellington's vocal repertoire is only now, in the 21st century, being fully appreciated. When age changed her voice in the 1970s, her decades of cumulative interpretive wisdom allowed her to adapt and innovate through new collaborations, particularly with Count Basie and the guitarist Joe Pass. Becoming Ella Fitzgerald thus chronicles a continuum of self-invention and resistance to a category, to use Duke Ellington's favorite term. She embraced hybridity. Diversity became her core identity, and surprise the wings of her imagination. Over a remarkably long career of 60 years or so, she fearlessly explored many different styles of American song through the lens of African-American jazz. She treated jazz as process, not confined to this idiom or that genre. And through her own transformative quests as an artist, she changed the trajectory of American vocal jazz in this century. A biography reflects its moment in time, and in writing this one, I pose questions and emphasize certain time periods from the vantage point of the early 21st century, guided by my own scholarly priorities. Since I did not write this book during Fitzgerald's lifetime, I did not encounter the frustrating lack of access problem that previous biographers faced, either from Ella Fitzgerald herself or from the business policies of her office in Los Angeles, or from friends who were thwarted from their own interviews. Instead, I was able to take advantage of modern resources in an effort to craft new scholarship on Fitzgerald, shining a light primarily on three neglected aspects of her life and work. My focus on the early part of her career emerged as a response to a new era of documentation through new technology of both recorded sound and print. The digitization of newspapers in the United States and in some European countries as well has made accounts of her successes and failures outside New York accessible. Although subjected to many paywall restrictions, newspapers from France, Germany, and Denmark yielded new interviews with Fitzgerald. Regional newspapers in the United States broadened my understanding of the nature of her reception at home. I was especially fortunate to have access to the extensive coverage that Fitzgerald's career received for a national black readership through widely circulated African-American newspapers. Among these important newspapers and journals were the Pittsburgh Courier and the Chicago Defender, both of which enjoyed national circulation. Both were digitized around 2010. Their extensive coverage of entertainment provided a rich font of new information about Fitzgerald's evolution in the 1930s and 40s. These sources serve as the foundation for the first three sections of this book. Of course, part of the editorial mission of the Black Press was to document racism in its full ignominy. As a white American, such racism was a part of my history and my present. The Civil Rights Revolution took place in my lifetime. As a music historian, I also knew how the history of American song reflected the mores of each era, promoting them, but also confounding them as well. Sometimes the documents of everyday life captured painful truths and astonishing assumptions. In 2004, I read the diary of a Southern white woman in 1858 who wrote, "One of my friends owned a real African princess. She must have been over 100 when I knew her. We dearly loved her songs, which were African ones, thrown into rough English by herself." Then followed decades of racist song and stereotypes familiar to American music historians. 100 years later, in 1958, here was Ella Fitzgerald, the first lady of song, accepting a Grammy Award. Offering a rich counterpoint to the sunnier mainstream coverage of her recording activities at Decca, the Black Press offered an overview of the cruel prejudice Fitzgerald had endured during tours outside the urban North. To those carefully tracking her ascension as a star, she was a community asset, a race woman as a symbol of excellence, one of the heroines of our history, in the words of Coretta Scott King in 1988. Black newspapers put within my scholarly grasp a way to begin to fill a void in the literature about Fitzgerald's career. Lacking lived experience within a black community, I took advantage of the access these new sources gave me to a world unknown to most white Americans at the time. The reportage of everyday life, along with pride in excellence and in honors and benchmarks of achievement, as sources of hope that sustained keeping on. Newspaper interviews with Fitzgerald, previously largely hidden from view, offered new insights into her early life in Yonkers and her thoughts at the start of her career. These precious resources helped shape my view of Ella's ambitions, bringing into focus, among other things, her role in the black community during these years. Those interviews in the black press enabled me to let Ella speak for herself. In writing this biography, I also relied on my own career as a second-wave feminist music historian who contributed to the development of women's history in Western classical music and in American musical life. I had provided entries in new encyclopedias, willing to cede space to topics about women in the wake of the women's movement of the 1970s and 80s. I had been engaged in chronicling the prejudice and discrimination that had burdened the creative autonomy of white women in 19th-century United States, socialized into dilettante roles through learning music as an accomplishment, discouraged from serious training, excluded from orchestras, crippled in access to instrumental education by the false masculine or feminine designations of certain instruments, ambition stigmatized as showing off. Perceiving and chronicling these themes were already part of my toolbox as a historian. Therefore, I gravitated toward Jane Crow, a term popularized by the black civil rights lawyer and feminist activist Pauli Murray, who in 1964 wrote, "Negro women, historically, have carried the dual burden of Jim Crow and Jane Crow." Murray, whose work would influence Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, used this formulation to describe the dual burden of sex discrimination and racial prejudice. She was building on a still-emerging history of black women in the United States, from which I benefited as well. I took one piece of this perspective to address Fitzgerald's experience. As a female African-American jazz singer, Fitzgerald was all too familiar with both Jim and Jane. Columns and interviews by early black female reporters and journalists amplify the picture of Fitzgerald's appeal to women in particular, who were invested in her success. In her historic 1937 interview with Lillian Johnson, Fitzgerald, then just 20 years old, summarized her then greatest challenge. "The public likes beauty, but when a girl comes up and she looks like me, she just can't get a chance." Over her lifetime, she challenged those conventions through different strategies, variously embracing glamour and telling self-deprecating jokes on stage, accepting that her phrase, "I'm just me," was more than enough. My second focus is on Fitzgerald's private life. Through archival, genealogical research and interviews with relatives, friends, and close associates, I assembled new factual documentation regarding her nuclear and extended family. A new death date for her mother resolved some of the discrepancies in Fitzgerald's own accounts of her life. New information about her stepfather, Antonio Corey, and her half-sister, Frances Corey, explains the many young children who lived with her in the 1960s and 70s. Fitzgerald's role as auntie helped ameliorate the absence of a steady partner in her later years. While she experienced ambivalence about her career, she did not change her habits of touring and living on the road. In tempering the image of her as a lonely, unhappily bereft single woman, I cite her personal selection of songs, and on occasion, even her changes in lyrics to reflect the woman inside the singer. She was honest enough to include the Burt Bacharach, Hal David ballad, "A House Is Not a Home," to her repertoire, both on stage and in recordings, even at times adding her own words, "without a man." Offstage, she accepted her unmarried state as a product of her nomadic lifestyle, along with the solitude and sometimes loneliness that fit her own sense of privacy. Besides, there were all those children making noise in her mansion. Like many who knew Fitzgerald, Oscar Peterson gestured to the psychological barriers she erected between herself and the public, calling her innately shy and insecure, a very private person who remained somewhat enigmatic even to her closest friends. And yet, Peterson knew her as a musician far better than most. He offered remarkable insight into her competitiveness, power, and imperturbable musical confidence, and the way she used her robust professional personality to prop up the less anchored woman inside. In that vein, I developed a perspective on Fitzgerald's improvisations, linking musical practice with lived experience. Through new scholarship from jazz experts, I learned how Ella forged personal connections by talking to other musicians on stage, whether they were physically there or not, that is, by quoting them in her improvisations. Hearing them, feeling their presence, and speaking to them as connoisseurs while pleasing the amateurs with obvious shout-outs to popular songs were all part of a calculated language through which she remained connected to her beloved community of musicians, as she called the instrumentalists she so admired, and whose superior stature in the hierarchy of jazz she accepted. Her practice of transforming her conversations into brilliant, often playful, competitive dialogues began early in her career and continued to the end, displayed in live recordings. I also have questioned the prevailing stereotype of Fitzgerald as an artist who ceded control of her artistic practices to Norman Granz, the producer and manager who brilliantly guided the second half of her career. They forged a historic partnership, to be sure. I do not doubt the veracity of musicians who called him a Svengali, a puppet master pulling the strings of his acolyte. She rarely challenged him in public, yet my approach to his influence is more skeptical. In Fitzgerald's lifetime, when he was asked, "How articulate is she about her music, her relationship, herself?" he was quoted as replying, "Not at all." I'd argue that another real response to that question is more than Granz was willing to grant. And through both her words and her music, I show how Fitzgerald, in fact, established her own agency. "He instilled in me confidence," she told a columnist for the Pittsburgh Courier in 1962. And that confidence transformed her artistry beyond Granz's reach. The third aspect of Fitzgerald's legacy that I explore in depth is the intellectual context of her reception as an artist. Although for decades, critics have taken for granted that vocal jazz was expendable in jazz history, I welcomed the change of perspective I encountered from younger music and cultural historians in the early 21st century. I was surprised to discover the extent to which Fitzgerald's stature as a jazz singer had been the subject of considerable controversy during her lifetime. Even as she earned accolades from jazz critics from the mid-1930s through the mid-1950s, thereafter, she became the focal point of aesthetic debates about her artistry. In 1961, Fitzgerald said, "I've heard where music critics say I'm not just a jazz singer anymore. But we all try to grow and improve. What is jazz, anyhow? I don't know. To me, jazz is music." Critics charged her with indifference to the lyrics she sang, a lack of emotional intelligence, a glib virtuosity, and a penchant for commercial opportunism. They noted the overplayed clichés leveled at Fitzgerald in discussions of her artistry, about her innocence, her natural ability, as opposed to learned craft, and her little girl persona on stage. In my assessment, these debates are byproducts of the void left by the still undocumented history of vocal jazz and its acknowledged second-class status within jazz history. This void demanded my attention. As a music scholar and a feminist, I felt personally challenged to fill it, to look at the ways patterns of gender bias in earlier American music were echoed in post-1950s jazz. This has enabled me to question the reductive oppositions between popular singing and jazz singing, between Billie Holiday and Ella, and between art and entertainment. The ebb and flow of commentary around Fitzgerald's music-making has a fascinating rhythm of its own, to quote her admirer, Ira Gershwin, leading me to include many reviews of records and live dates in this book. The conversations between Fitzgerald and her listeners via recording and the experience of seeing her on stage tell it.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?